It's Latino Heritage Month, and today more than 50 million Latinos live in the United States, comprising a significant part of American culture and history.
In his new book, Latino Americans, which accompanies a new PBS series by the same name, our next guest chronicles that history and challenges us to think differently about the cultural fabric that weaves America together.
Ray Suarez is senior correspondent for PBS NewsHour and author of Latino Americans, the 500-year legacy that shaped a nation. Ray, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
Will you tell us why you're calling this the Latino moment?
Well, I think a lot of people, including people who are even in the business of demography, weren't expecting the 2010 census to tell us that there were more than 50 million Latinos living in the country. And that was one of those wake-up moments, along with school systems across the country, in places you'd expect and places you wouldn't expect, to have one out of every two of their incoming kindergarten class be Latino. One out of three teenagers in high schools across the country. It is a sort of cross-hatching set of circumstances coming together. Not only the places you predict, like Miami or Los Angeles or New York, but places that are less predictable, like Lumberton, North Carolina, and Dalton, Georgia, the Yakima Valley of Washington. Latinos are on the scene. They're the new kids on the block, and it's changing the country.
Well, if this is Latino moment, as you say, it's been a long time coming. Why has Latino history been pushed to the margins over the years?
Well, you know, if it's true that the winners get to write the histories, well, you know, a lot of the people who had a part in drawing the map of the United States as it is did it by either buying out Latinos or just pushing them out of the land with force of arms or force of money. So while Mexico or the Spanish Empire was a part of 23 different states of the U.S. Union, we tend to play down that part of our past. We tend to forget that part of our history. And if you're sitting on a choked expressway between San Diego and Los Angeles, you're not thinking about the fact that those are two Spanish names, and there's a reason for that.
Well, it's interesting for me on a personal level. I'm Latino. My father was from Mexico. And growing up in rural Wisconsin, I never met anyone else who was Latino. They all thought I looked weird. And at the time, I would lie and tell people I was Portuguese or something. And now I look around me and there's lots of people who look like me. So what changes when a community of people become acknowledged in the mainstream and claim their history and are seen more fully?
Well, the first thing that happens is the majority gets a little uncomfortable. And I think in some of the tone of the discussion about immigration and assimilation that we're having now in the United States, you can hear a little bit of that panicky tone. And that's unfortunate because people have been coming here since the 16th century and making the place what it is. And Latinos have been here since the very beginning and arrived yesterday. And that's unlike any other group. And, you know, if you want to be honest about who's picking your strawberries and your lettuce and babysitting your kids and cleaning up after your elderly in home care situations and in nursing homes across the country, doing drywall and laying sod in new subdivisions, a lot of the work that gets done in the United States every day is done by some of those 50 million hardworking people. There are plenty of other Americans working hard too, but instead of becoming part of the party, we're still held a little bit at arm's length. And this history, I think, is for both groups of people, both Latinos who know a little bit about their history and want to know more, and other Americans who want to integrate this history in what they already know about America.
Now, the PBS series and your book capture 500 years. That's an incredible scope. How do you go about trying to trace that much history?
Well, the short answer is it's really hard. You're constantly making these terrible choices about leaving this in or taking this out because you can't write an exhaustive history. It has to just be a survey to give people a handle on the story. So we picked, the television team and I, a group of people who represent the Latino state in America as history moves along. So during the Depression and World War II era, during the 19th century when the United States is arriving in what used to be Mexico, in Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, California, as Latinos are joining the spirit of the 60s and launching their own civil rights movement that in many ways mirrors and takes its inspiration from the Black civil rights movement. These are all moments in history that tell us something about the country at large, but also tell us something about the Latino community at that time.
Now, you're talking about a Latino civil rights movement, and I think a lot of people would be unaware that such a thing had happened, unlike the Black civil rights movement. Can you make the case for, you know, when that happened and what happened?
Very similar to Black Americans. When Latino GIs came back by their hundreds of thousands when the war was over, and people came back from the defense plants and doing civilian work on the bases, they had just helped the United States beat fascist genocidal regimes in other places in the world and helped give other people back their freedom. And they came back to the Rio Grande Valley, or they came back to Fresno and San Joaquin and Phoenix, and found that they had a separate set of schools, lived in divided communities where there would be the town, and then there'd be the Mexican part of town where there was no indoor plumbing, no modern sewerage, no updated water systems.
And we're going to have to leave it there for now, Ray, and pick it up in just a moment. We're talking with Ray Suarez, author of Latino Americans, The 500-Year Legacy That Shaped a Nation.
You can join in at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234 with your questions and experiences. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with PBS's Ray Suarez about the series Latino Americans, The 500-Year Legacy That Shaped a Nation, and his companion book by the same name.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you see the influence of Latinos in America? Do you have a question about the role they've played in American culture or the history? Or do you have a personal experience, maybe an immigrant yourself, a recent immigrant, or you could talk about your family's history? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 642-1234, or you can send an email, talk@WPR.org.
And Ray, before we heard the news there, you were talking about a Latino civil rights movement. Do you want to pick up where you left off there?
Well, they had come back, the veterans, from winning the Second World War, and were not inclined to live as second-class citizens after going and bringing freedom to countries around the world. So they began to agitate for voting rights, better access to education and housing, better facilities, public access to infrastructure like sewers, like highways, and it went on from there. The GIs were the seedbed from which both the Black and Latino civil rights movements grew, and they took different forms in the East Coast and the West, but they were fighting for many of the same things.
Now, you mentioned World War II, and you know, a large chunk of the book is dedicated to that. There's lots of incredible stories. There are many that we probably haven't heard in standard school texts so far, anyway. And one tells the story of Eugene Calderon, who had an incredible contribution during the war. Could you tell us his story?
Eugene Calderon was a fascinating guy. He comes out of Spanish Harlem in Upper Manhattan. He was a gang boy. He was getting into trouble. And to stay one step ahead of the law, he enlists and goes away and becomes a man in the service. But also experiences some of the ambivalence that the United States has about mixed-race people, because he signs up for the Army Air Corps, is quartered with white troops who say, "What's he doing here? He's not white." And when he's assigned to the Tuskegee Airmen, the Tuskegee Airmen say, "What's he doing here? He's not black. He's a Puerto Rican guy from New York." He goes on to use his GI benefits to get an advanced degree, becomes one of the first Puerto Rican upper-level managers of the New York City Board of Education, becomes one of the founders of several of the most important cultural institutions for Latinos in New York City. And it's just one of those stories where a kid who was headed nowhere fast goes through this amazing experience of the war and has his life reshaped by it and goes on to make a tremendous contribution in New York City.
And how was he treated when he first came back?
Well, his son tells the story of Eugene going back to the police precinct where he had unfortunately spent a lot of his teenage years, and they still had outstanding warrants for him. But he went in there to tell them that he was now signed up in the police academy and was going to be an officer like them. And he goes on to found the Association of Latino Police Officers in New York City, which does a lot of the work fighting for the right to take officers' exams, to become sergeants, to become lieutenants, and which had been largely closed to minority applicants. The ranks of the upper management levels of New York City Police Department, like many departments around the country, were virtually closed to black and brown applicants. And Eugene Calderon had a hand in that as well.
What history lessons did you come across, strands of Latino history, that were revelatory even to you, and you thought, you know, people really need to know about this?
The thing that struck me again and again was how difficult America was finding it to accommodate these people. And at the same time, Latinos don't become a country within a country. They don't become a separate culture, alienated, checked out of the rest of the United States, but keep coming back and keep coming back and keep participating and keep pushing ahead. And it's really touching, in a way, to see this tremendous desire for acceptance and love of country that keeps pushing the community forward, at the same time as new arrivals are coming all the time and making it a not quite clear-cut picture. Who are these people? How long have they been here? Well, the answer is since yesterday and 500 years. And you're just going to have to wrap your head around that, America, because both things are true with both sets of problems, both that desire for acceptance as a people long in the country and the need for a different kind of help because you just got here.
You know, we know a lot about Japanese internment camps during the war, but I hadn't heard some of the stories about how around that same time, Latino families were, you know, quote unquote, sent back to Mexico. And some of these kids had never been to Mexico. They were Americans, and yet they were sent back. And that's not a story you hear very often.
Thousands of mixed status families were sent back to Mexico during the Depression. The Secretary of Labor and the heads of the various immigration agencies and state governors got together and decided one way to solve their near-term unemployment problems was to simply round up large numbers of Mexicans and Mexican-Americans and send them back south of the border. It was a crazy time. America was obviously really frightened of the Depression. It was capitalism having a nervous breakdown. When you hear about things like the Okies heading west and finding armed officers at the entrances to California, turning people back, these are not things that you think, well, wait a minute, that can't happen in America, can it? Can someone in a uniform with a gun tell you you simply can't enter California? That kind of thing was happening, as was trains being loaded up with eventually almost 500,000 Mexicans and Mexican-Americans and sent south into Mexico, and those people told not to come back.
Do you know what happened to most of them? Did they stay there, or did they try to re-enter eventually?
Well, you know, it's a very mixed picture. Some do eventually re-enter because we go from labor oversupply during the Depression to labor hunger during World War II. So some people filter back. Those who were older but also American-born had an easier time making their way back because of their added facility in English, their ability to get the papers they needed to demonstrate their citizenship. But a lot of people were just swept up and sent back and stayed there, even though many could establish their legal right to live in the United States. And as I mentioned, the country ended up needing them just a few years later, once the war is in full swing.
Let's see if we can get one call in. We have Pat joining us from Grafton. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I am a first-generation Italian-American, and I know we haven't had as much discrimination as Latinos, but this, you know, there's a lot of similarities, and you know, so that story does resonate with me. And my father is Irish-German and was from Northeast Wisconsin, and you know, eventually we were accepted by his family, but you know, his grandmother had a hard time with the marriage. She considered it you know, I guess a mixed marriage of sorts, and she had a you know, she had a problem with my wearing earrings and my Italian grandmother living with us and so on. But you know, eventually to keep a relationship with us, she became to be a lot more expecting, you know, accepting and so on. So a lot of this does resonate a little bit, and I know that some of the history is very similar, and it's been a very good broadcast. I've enjoyed listening to it.
All right. Thank you so much for your call, Pat. Appreciate that. And Ray, you know, are Latinos in America, have they faced, you know, the similar trajectory of other immigrant groups like Pat was just talking about, or is there something different about this experience?
Well, I think the primary difference, and thank you for your call, is that when you look at the immigration patterns of the Germans, of the Irish, of the Italians, of the Jews of Eastern Europe, there was a run-up, an enormous spike, and then a subsidence. With all, you know, the years may have been different, but the pattern was the same. And then large numbers stopped coming, and the country digested what was here already. And that was certainly the case in the United States during the 20th century, where we rewrote the immigration laws in 1925, slammed the door shut after the stock market crash in 1929. Then we had the Depression, the Second World War, and recovery in Europe in the 50s, so people stopped coming. Those were years of very low immigration. So those people who came before the door was slammed shut, their families assimilated. Their families learned English and forgot the languages of their home countries in many cases. And the number of foreign-born got down to a very low level by 1965, when we rewrote the immigration laws once again and threw the door open to the rest of the world, not just Europe, the traditional source of American immigrants. So people began pouring in from new places, different places. So this latest experience of immigration has been a little different one from the one that we had from 1870 to 1920, where millions, 80 million people, eventually had either were immigrants themselves or had immigrant parents. We digested those huge inflows from Europe in part because we stopped taking new immigrants. But the pattern with Latinos is different, and they came in large numbers in the 70s. They came in large numbers in the 80s, then again in the 90s. Then even until the wheels fell off the economy with the Great Recession, we're still coming in large numbers until then. It's just a different kind of pattern. You don't have that spike and then a subsidence down to nothing.
Ray, the series has just started airing. What kind of reception is it getting so far?
So far, so good. The second installment is on tonight, so if you're near a TV, please do take a look. The war years and the years just after are profiled, and the Cuban refugee flow and so on. So we've got some great stories to tell tonight. The reception has been very good, and a couple of people have complained about an anti-American tone, and some people have said we've exaggerated the trials and challenges that have faced Latinos over the years. But the historical record is the historical record. It speaks for itself, and there's nothing anti-American about a country that has taken on these people, not always been so happy that they're here, but once it gets used to the idea, is is changing, absorbing, and reflecting the fact that we are a changed people. We've done that over and over again. We've been here before. So there's nothing anti-American about reminding the rest of us how hard it can be to come to this country from somewhere else in the world.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
That was Ray Suarez, author of Latino Americans, the 500-year legacy that shaped a nation. And you can catch that next installment of the PBS series, Latino Americans, tonight at 7 o'clock on Wisconsin Public Television.
Coming up, we'll take a look at changes to Badger Care, why 92,000 people may soon lose coverage. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.